Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of F This Movie. It's time to start the music. It's time to light the lights. It's time to talk about The Muppet Movie with my guest, Eric Asperschlager. How are you, Eric?
Hi-ho!
Oh, nice. Do you do all the Muppets or just Kermit?
Yeah, they all sound like Kermit.
Oh, all right. Well, then yeah. We should be fine. My name is Patrick Brownlee, and you're listening to F This Movie, the official podcast of the F This Movie podcast. You can find our website at fthismovie.blogspot.com. You can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/fthismovie. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie. In the iTunes store by searching F This Movie. And you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Like I said, we're talking about the Muppet Movie this week because I believe the day that this podcast comes out is also the day that the new Muppet Movie, which is just called The Muppets, will be released into theaters. Will you be seeing The Muppets, Eric?
When I get a chance to, I'm looking forward to it. And yeah. This is certainly the impetus for this podcast. So it's been a long time since I've been excited about a Muppet movie.
Yeah.
And so that's hopefully a good thing. We'll see.
Yeah, I'm curious to see. It's getting good reviews so far, so I'm pretty excited about it. But before we start our conversation about the Muppet movie, Eric, have you seen anything good lately?
Well, I tell you, I was all set today.
All right.
To watch something that I thought, well, we're going to do Muppets, you know, kids, family. I wanted to watch something that was maybe in that vein. And on my Netflix instant queue was Follow That Bird.
Sure.
Sesame Street, which I remember liking a lot when I saw in the theater. And it just would not load. It would not come up at all. It got 7% and just kind of got stuck. So instead, I guess I'll talk briefly about Reservoir Dogs. Because in this binary black and white world we live in, it really comes down to either Sesame Street movies or violent Quentin Tarantino films. I don't think there's much of an in-between, and if there is, I don't want to know about it. But, I saw Reservoir Dogs for the first time in probably a decade or so since I first saw it. It was the second time I'd ever seen it. And, I'd seen Pulp Fiction before that, and then I think most everything else of Quentin Tarantino's I saw after it. So it had been a long time, and I was kind of struck by how little there is to the movie. It feels, I know that we had a little bit of this conversation in email, but we'll pretend we didn't for the sake of the audience, which is why I shouldn't have said what I just said. But it's a movie that in which very little happens. And it's probably a credit to Tarantino that in my mind, I remembered way more stuff happening in the movie than actually does. I mean, most of the movie takes place in a warehouse where people are talking about an exciting diamond heist that you never actually see on screen. But it kind of has the feel of like a proof of concept, or like a template for all of Tarantino's other movies. And, you know, I think in that regard, it works. I mean, it definitely holds together from beginning to end. It has, you know, it has the cool music. It has the cool dialogue. It has the nonlinear storytelling. It has the great acting. It has everything you want from a Tarantino movie, except maybe the depth. And I think that's sort of where it left me feeling like, oh, that felt like a bit like a short story. Maybe I wanted a novel, but, it's weird to go back and look at directors' first movies like that. Mm-hmm. Watching it, I was thinking a little bit about another podcast I was on. We talked about Wes Anderson movies, and that got me thinking a little bit about Bottle Rocket, because that's kind of a similar thing, but for Wes Anderson. That was a movie that, you know, you watch it now, it feels a bit slight, but it has all of the things that would make a Wes Anderson movie a Wes Anderson movie.
Right.
And I think like Reservoir Dogs, no one would or no one should say that it's their favorite Wes Anderson movie, just like no one should say that Reservoir Dogs is their favorite Tarantino movie, because if they do, they haven't seen any other Tarantino movies.
Right. I think that there are people that say that, and I wonder if it's people who just feel like, I don't know, and this is not a judgment on these people, but it's like, I can almost hear the voice of someone saying, like, he hasn't done anything good since Reservoir Dogs. Well, that's nonsense, because,
right,
as you said, Reservoir Dogs, and even to an extent Pulp Fiction, which I think is a better movie than Reservoir Dogs, are both kind of about nothing, you know? They're sort of about their plot and very much about the style, but they're not about much thematically speaking, which I think his later movies are.
Well, there's more in Pulp Fiction, certainly than Reservoir Dogs. There's more redemptive stuff and some more thematic elements that I'll find out about as soon as I get the Blu-ray to be in the mail.
For the price of 16 quarters, I believe.
Something correct? Like that. Yeah. I'm not good with math. That sounds about right. Yeah,
you got to love Black Friday week. I mean, it just continues to seep out over the course of a week.
It's a black time in our country. Couldn't be happier.
There are many deals to be found.
Yeah, I guess you'll be hearing this early enough to get in on many of them. So keep your eyes out.
Yeah.
A lot of good movie deals. And I guess getting back to the whole first movies thing.
Right.
For a second, then we get back to just making random jokes. That's fine. It's funny because I think about it also in terms of like of Clerks, which Kevin Smith's first movie, which. Kind of a similar time frame, I think. Mm-hmm. I can't remember exact years. But considering the way his career went, I don't think it would be unreasonable for someone to say that that was their favorite Kevin Smith movie.
Yeah, I would agree with
you think,
that.
I mean, I think in a different kind of way. I mean, I don't know that he's lived up to this, the promise, the way Tarantino and Wes Anderson have. And maybe it's unfair to compare the three, but they kind of all came on the scene around the first time. Their movies all have a very specific feeling that's unique to that director that you could say, oh, that's a Kevin Smith movie. Oh, that's a Tarantino movie. But
and Bottle Rocket and Reservoir Dogs are both very much first movies, but sort of a rare first movie that, like you said, you could totally see each filmmaker in there. And both those guys sort of really grew with each successive movie, although I could maybe make an argument that Wes Anderson has sort of flatlined a little bit in terms of artistic growth, but and Kevin Smith kind of never did beyond Clerks.
Right.
So in a way, Clerks is sort of the purest distillation of like what a Kevin Smith movie is. You know, I think I like Chasing Amy better, again, because it's about something a little bit more, but
sure.
I would say Clerks is probably my second favorite Kevin Smith movie, and that was his first one. So
right.
I don't know.
All right, so a bit of a depressing note, but
yeah. All right, great.
Come on, bring us up, Bromley.
Well, listen, it's not getting any better from here because it is. I saw Cocoon for the first time.
Oh, I haven't seen that movie since the Disney Channel, probably in like '88.
Yeah, it completely escaped me in the '80s. I think because I was a kid and I was like, well, that movie's about old people, and then. After I saw Super 8, which we were just talking about before we started recording, I started trying to track down some of these 80s sort of nice alien movies that came out around the time of E.T. And Cocoon especially, because they used the music from Cocoon in the trailer for Super 8, which is like my favorite trailer of the year. So I wanted to see Cocoon. It showed up on like HBO, so I DVR'd it. It's fine. I don't know. I don't see what the big deal is, but it's certainly not worth the 25-year wait. Not that I was waiting 25 years to see Cocoon, but it's just like, hey, I saw Cocoon. Ron Howard is great at making movies that are fine, but so not anything beyond that, you know?
TM.
Yeah, he very rarely makes a movie. Like Apollo 13 is like, wow, that was really good, but usually it's just like, why Ron Howard? Another double, you know, or I can't speak in sports metaphors. I think a double is about average, right?
Sure, another completed pass.
Exactly. Just that's way to go.
That's a football reference.
So I don't know. I mean, I got to see, Hume Cronin and Wilford Brimley and Don Ameche all like breakdance and jump into a pool. I don't know.
I can't remember. Is this the origin of the rapping old people phenomenon?
I don't believe they rap, but there is definitely a Don Ameche full-on breakdance sequence with obvious body double. And again, it's like fine.
Look a bit like that old guy in the roller coaster commercials.
Yes, absolutely. The creepy dude from Six Flags. Again, it's like, okay, I like that there's a different take on sort of the alien invasion. Not all the aliens want to kill us. Sometimes they just want to take our elderly. And that's fine, I say. They're not doing anything. No, I'm just kidding.
Frankly, that sounds like a reasonable solution to our social security situation.
Aliens, help us out.
Why not?
And then yesterday, there was a theater in Chicago that I went to that was doing a screening of a movie. I don't know if you've heard of it. I don't remember the name. It's about this teenager who finds a time machine and travels back to 1955, and he meets his parents and has to get them together. I cannot remember the name of the movie to save my life.
It's Cocoon 2.
Cocoon 2: The Return, I believe, was what it was called. So yeah, I got to see Back to the Future in a theater for the second time in maybe a year, and it was great. Obviously, I've spoken at length about my affection for that movie. This was especially cool, because it was in a theater that I had not yet been to. It's a newly restored theater in Chicago, and it was my first time there. And B, because it was the tickets were like $3, and it was a matinee, so it attracted a lot of families and kids who hadn't seen the movie before. So I was seeing the movie in an audience of mostly new viewers, and it was great to hear all the jokes play and all spontaneous applause. At several points through the movie, that movie has so many great applause moments. So it was a lot of fun to hear people react to that movie for the first time.
That's great. It is, I think you have made the case that it's one of the best movies ever made, and I would have to agree with that. It's infinitely rewatchable.
It is.
So great.
It's amazing to me. And again, I just saw it maybe a year and a half ago at a different theater. It's amazing to me how fast that movie moves, because again, I was struck by, we get to the point where Marty's getting dressed to go to the Enchantment Under the Sea dance, and I can't believe we're there already, because it feels like the movie's only been on for about 40 minutes.
Well, it is moving at 88 miles per hour.
Oh, good point. So yes, I have said that it's the best movie ever made, and of course I believe that. I know that that's probably not true, but I will say, objectively, I do think it's one of the best screenplays ever written. Mm-hmm. There is nothing wasted in that screenplay. Film students should watch just the first 15 minutes to learn how to do exposition, because they set so much up without even any dialogue. It's incredible, that screenplay.
And I'd seen that movie so many times, and I watched it to review the DVD a couple of years ago. And there are things I saw in it that I'd never seen before. Little touches. There's the very beginning when they're skating past all the clocks, and there's one with the guy hanging off of the hand of the clocks. I can't remember the silent film actor's name, but
Harold Lloyd.
There you go, Harold Lloyd. And it's like, oh, there you go. That's genius.
It is. That movie is airtight. I mean, the way they set things up and pay them off, it's incredible. I think at the very least,
it is the best PG rated film with an attempted rape scene I've ever seen. And I think it can at least
But to be fair, you weren't able to watch Follow That Bird today. So you can't.
No, I wasn't. Well, that's a G rated film.
You can't. Oh, good point. That's a good G rated rape. Let me ask you a question, because there's an ongoing, not debate, I don't know, it's mostly just with Doug from F This Movie, but do you have a preference in terms of the sequels of Back to the Future? Do you prefer.
You mean which of the sequels I prefer?
Yes.
I've always been partial to two.
Okay.
I would probably go with two. I mean, I know it's kind of a mess, but I like the fact that they're going all around, and I like the fact that it's complicated.
Yeah. I think I'm with you, but Doug swears three is better.
I mean, three maybe, as a movie with a beginning, middle, and end, but I don't know that the Old West is that exciting to me. It's certainly not as exciting as, the alternate Biffiverse where Marty's mom has huge boobs and he runs a casino and there are like fires all over the place. I mean, it's just, there's a lot of, it's a really fun, movie.
Yeah. So, and it's super sort of ambitious in a different way. And it is way more like almost like a Looney Tunes cartoon than the first movie. And I think maybe that's what puts some people off. My problem with the third movie, because, yeah, it's fine. It's just that, to me, it only works. Like, to do one as a Western only works if you do, like, four more.
Yeah.
And each one is a different, time period or whatever. Because to have one be this story in 1955 and then the second one be this story in 1955 and then all of a sudden, like, and the third one's a Western. It doesn't work for me, but.
I mean, maybe if it were set in prehistoric times.
Exactly.
I can get behind. I mean, almost anything is more interesting at this point than the Old West. Nothing's wrong with the Old West. Ed Wood is great and stuff. And there are a lot of, like, John Wayne, awesome. But, like, I don't know. You got a time machine.
Yeah.
Go somewhere cool.
Prehistoric times. I want to see the Biffosaurus.
Yes, exactly. I mean, well, Biff would be like a, kind of a Neanderthal type of.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I think that's how it would work. I guess Marty's mom would be some sort of fish with legs. I'm not sure, but
nice. I like it crawling out of the murk. Let's talk about the Muppet movie, sir. This was a suggestion that you had come up with a while ago, in like you said, in honor of the new Muppet movie coming out, that we would talk about the Muppet movie. The Muppets are everywhere these days. It is there's nothing they aren't advertising. They're showing any TV show you watch. At some point, the Muppets appear. They were solving cases on Law and Order SVU the other night.
Wait, were they?
They were not. Didn't really.
I don't have TV anymore.
That
so
did
I
not
tell.
Really happen. Well, then I could just make anything up, and sure. You would perhaps believe me.
They were on How I Met Your Muppet. That was
nice. Wow, look at you! Oof. Look at you! So let's talk about the Muppet movie. I was actually surprised to realize today we're mostly talking about the original Muppet movie, but of course we both watched The Great Muppet Caper and The Muppets Take Manhattan, which is really the sort of the original trilogy, right? Those are the only ones that matter. Because there was a Muppet Christmas Carol, there was Muppet Treasure Island, there was Muppets from Space, and I think I've seen the first two of those. I've never seen Muppets from Space, because at a certain point I just kind of checked out, because it didn't feel like the Muppets anymore. I guess because Jim Henson was gone. I don't know.
I think so. I mean, I think that is your dividing line.
Right.
Muppets is the death of Jim Henson. And I think not long after that was when the rights to the Muppets went to Disney.
Yeah.
So that, I think, marked a big shift, and there are, you know, negative sides to that as well. But I think you look at the if we're talking just Muppets, then the original Muppet trilogy holds as, you know.
I was surprised to discover that Jim Henson only directed one of those three movies. I've always kind of had it in my head that he directed all three of the original Muppet movies, but he only did Great Muppet Caper.
That's right.
The first movie was directed by a guy named James Frawley, who was kind of an outsider to the whole Muppet thing. They just, you know, hired an actual movie director. And Muppets Take Manhattan was directed by Frank Oz. Of the three, do you have a clear-cut favorite?
Yes, Muppet Movie is my favorite of the three.
Yeah.
I think growing up, I watched Great Muppet Caper most. I remember having that recorded that off of something off TV and watching it endlessly. So I'm sure I saw that the most times, but now watching them, you know, all kind of pretty much back to back, it's pretty clear that the Muppet Movie is the best one.
I think I was in a similar situation that growing up, Great Muppet Caper was my favorite. And I don't know why, because rewatching it, it was sort of like a Return of the Jedi finale. I think Great Muppet Caper is the Return of the Jedi of the Muppet trilogy, because as a kid, Jedi was my favorite because it had all the cool stuff. It had Jabba and the Rancor and the Ewoks and Endor and all that. And then you grow up and you're watching, you're like, oh, this is not very good. And which isn't to say that Great Muppet Caper is not very good, but it's just it can't compete with the original Muppet movie. And I don't necessarily know why that is. Like, what do you suppose? Obviously the Muppets are crazy popular and have incredible longevity. Why do you suppose that is?
It seems to me, and I think that what's great about the Muppets in general is that, and I don't even want to say that, you know, it's a kid's show, but it's made for adults, because that doesn't really make sense. But it works on pretty much every level. You grow into the show, you grow into the movies, you grow into the jokes. So there's something for when you're a kid that's really appealing about the Muppet Show or about the movies. There's just fun. There's Gonzo and balloons. It's great. And then as you get older, you start to get some of the more mature jokes and. So I think even as you get through all the way through the Muppet movie, you see that there's some pretty heavy themes in there too, about, you know, disappointment and dreams and selling out to corporations and all these kind of, I think, ideas and themes that are largely absent from the the other movies. And then yeah. Great Muppet Caper is really just sort of it's a caper. It's just sort of a fun thing. I mean, they started off with a big musical number, and then it's just kind of a bunch of jokes and musical numbers from that point on. And we can talk about the music later, but I think that kind of on every level, the first Muppet movie just kind of holds together better and is more maybe in line with what was great about the TV show and kind of works about, you know, works with the Muppets as far as it kind of being all encompassing.
Yeah. You know, watching it again, I was not struck by how funny it still is, because I always knew it was funny, but I mean, you make a great point, because I think there's a propensity now with children's entertainment, and Pixar has, you know, figured out the way to make stuff that can appeal to kids and adults, but not necessarily on two totally separate levels. The movie I always point to is like the Shrek movies, where it's like there's jokes for kids because Shrek farts and burps, and but then there's jokes for adults, which is like references to other movies. Or in the trailer for that new Puss in Boots movie, JB has talked before on the podcast about how there's some like prison rape joke with Humpty Dumpty. It's like, that's the joke for the adults that the kids won't get. And that's a nightmare. Like, I don't need the jokes to be separate. I don't need them to like try and smuggle in dirty stuff in order to make the adults laugh, because the Muppet movie doesn't necessarily have like, there's this level of jokes that's just for kids and this level of jokes that's just for adults. It's sort of all going on at the same time. And either you get it or you don't. And it's weird, because even as a kid, I feel like I was responding to jokes that I don't think I got, but like I knew that they were jokes.
Sure. I guess a good example of an adult joke in the Muppet movie is, you know, Don DeLuise in the boat comes to Kermit, says he's lost. Kermit asks, have you tried Hare Krishna? Like that's a joke. And that's a joke that as a kid, I probably knew it. That's a joke.
Right.
You know, or when they go into the church where Dr. Teeth is playing and Fozzie says, they don't look like Presbyterians to me. like that's a joke a kid's not really going to get. I mean, that's a joke for an adult, but I mean, that's a funny joke.
Right.
It's an adult joke, but right. It's not, you know, an angry symbol.
Right. And that's one of the things that's so great about especially the first Muppet movie, is that it is, while it is like you said, that on one level that it is dealing with some things that I think are very personal to Jim Henson, particularly the whole selling out to corporations plot line, but also realizing your dreams and so there is an underlying sadness to the movie. I mean, that whole campfire scene where Gonzo is singing, that's so sad, right?
I mean, I think as far as the music, I mean, there are moments and scenes and songs in this movie that get me every time.
Even
that,
Rainbow Connection, that's the first five minutes.
Absolutely. I mean, that song still gets me. Yeah. The song you're referencing, I'm going to go back there someday.
Yeah.
I mean, that just, I'm getting chills just thinking about it. I mean, and it's being sung by a whatever. Like, I don't So it's the ability for the movie to juggle all these kind of silly things and really adult things, but present them in a way that I think kids can understand, but adults can really appreciate. I think you're right. I don't think Jim Henson ever thought in terms of, you know, this is for the adults and this is for the kids. He just had this childlike sense of wonder and joy and playfulness. And you can, you know, you can address really, you know, serious, you know, issues or, you know, real life things in silly, playful ways. And I think he had a real gift for doing that.
Yeah. It's a reminder that sort of this idea of the family, you know, film, which has again sort of come back into fashion somewhat with Pixar because they figured out how to do it, but it was really sort of a dead art form. And the Muppet movie is such a great example of that, which is just like, there's not these jokes and these jokes and these jokes, or there's not these themes and these themes and these themes. It's just, this is the movie for everyone. And like you said, you grow into it, you take out of it what you get at a certain age or at a certain place in your life or whatever. While the movie, I don't think was as sort of rich thematically, there was a movie that came out earlier this year that you just wrote a great review of for DVD Verdict, which was Winnie the Pooh. Which I think is another good example of a movie that's really for everyone and is just funny without dividing up, you know, these jokes and these jokes and these jokes. And not enough people saw that movie. And that was just a shameless advertisement for Winnie the Pooh, because I think it's so great.
No, yeah, it is great. I mean, there's something, I guess it does, you know, share a lot in common with, you know, the Muppet movie, just in a general tone. I mean, they're just uncynical movies. Right. Nothing about them feels calculated. Nothing about it feels like it's playing to a specific demographic or focus group. It just feels like, you know, here is something that is just really special and happens to appeal to kids and adults. And if we want to call that a family film, then so be it. But it's just great.
That, I think, is the word that best encapsulates the original Muppet movie, which is just special. I mean, it's like such a lightning in a bottle thing, because while the Muppet Show on TV was great, it was very much, I mean, it was almost like a Marx Brothers movie, you know? It was just slapstick and really broad comedy and songs and dances. And so it's amazing to me that the translation to movies actually made it that much better, because I think that sort of rarely happens, you know?
When
a TV show gets turned into a movie, it doesn't often improve the source material, but this does, and part of it is because it has that, I mean, the whole first half of the movie has that whole, you know, Blues Brothers, let's get the band together storyline, which is part of what I think is lacking from the second two movies. That the Great Muppet Caper, like you said, it tries to just have a plot, and that's fine, but it's like, it's not quite the same thing. And the Muppets Take Manhattan, to me, one of my big problems with that movie has always been that it splits the Muppets up for part of the, and while they're not together for all of the Muppet movie, there's that sense of like they're coming together as opposed to being driven apart, if that makes sense.
No, it does. Absolutely. I think that, and I, part of me wonders what the Muppet movie would be like if we didn't have, you know, the bookend of watching the Muppets watch the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because that, I mean, there really is a movie within a movie, and then at the end there's a movie within a movie within a movie. So, I mean, there's already this kind of meta level. And it's the kind of framework that, you know, makes some of the, not sillier stuff, but some of the kind of shorthand parts of the movie make sense. Like it's a great, you know, great scene at the end when they get to Hollywood. And, you know, it turns out to be this magic store. They get into the office where, of course, Orson Welles is, you know, is the guy behind the desk. And they just say, we want to be in movies. And he just says, draw up the standard rich and famous contract. Like, that exists. And it's so, you know, I mean, it's not obviously how Hollywood works, but it's just so kind of fun. And like, you know, it's just so kind of joyful. So I think it's great that they're able to do that kind of fourth wall breaking stuff, and obviously that's a hallmark of all the Muppet movies. Although much less so in the third movie. I didn't rewatch the third one this time because I'd watched it recently to review it. But in the second movie, you know, they go right for that fourth wall stuff, saying, you know, we're in a movie and this is what the movie's about. And in it, Kermit plays the reporter and Fozzie plays the.
And they're talking about the credits as they're going, right?
Yeah, which is great. I mean, I think there's a lot of, you know, really great stuff in Great Muppet Caper, and you know, when they say, "Oh, it's time to start the movie now," and then they have the great opening number about, you know, the movie. The first one does it, I think, in a more organic kind of effortless way, where it's a movie within a movie, so they can make references to things. You know, they know they're in a movie at times. There's a whole plot point that revolves around giving someone the screenplay, you know, which feels like something out of a Mel Brooks movie. There's Mel Brooks is in the movie at one point. Cameos. There's just so many great things about this movie, and I think, like the TV show, it sort of bridges a time period between, you know, when we had all these like variety shows and old 50s TV shows where you'd have walk-on cameos by there's Milton Berle and there's, you know, Bob Hope. So you have all these old stars coming on mixed with newer people like Richard Pryor and, you know, and so on, that you, I don't know, there's just a weird kind of, just a great melding of old and new kind of show business. It's just kind of a real great show business feel. And it's a very uncynical show business movie without ever feeling like it's being dishonest about, you know, what it means to be in show business. I think the fact that you have Doc Hopper, who's trying to basically make Kermit be the spokesperson for a restaurant chain that kills frogs in this magical world where everyone eats at frogs legs, a fast food restaurant, because that's the thing. But it's great. Like, I don't question that. Like, of course.
Right.
Of course Doc Hopper exists.
Well, and the movie needs a villain, obviously. So.
Yeah, and I think it's great that he's such an unapologetically evil villain. I mean, he gets to a point, you know, near the end of the movie where they're in the old West town, and Kermit does his great, you know, redemptive speech and saying, you know, you don't have to be this way. If you really feel that way, then go ahead and kill us. And says, okay, kill us. You know, I mean, he's a bad guy, and I don't even think you get bad guys like that in family movies anymore, because they'd just be seen as too much for kids. But
right.
You know, Jim Henson knows that, you know, kids know that there are bad people out there, you know, right, in movies, and they can handle that kind of stuff. And even the fact that, you know, Max, you know, who does kind of turn around at the end, you know, it takes a long time to get there. I mean, he does have a moment. Max is Doc Hopper's assistant. If you haven't seen the movie or haven't seen it in a while, and either way, get to seeing it. But, you know, there's a moment where he kind of questions Doc's motives and says, well, maybe we shouldn't do this. Maybe Kermit's right. And then Doc Hopper offers him more money and says, oh, okay, I'll drive the car. So it's... So I mean, this is pretty. If you really look at it, it's pretty, you know, heavy stuff for a kids' movie.
Right.
You know, the motivations are kind of real motivations, or have their real world counterparts anyway.
Well, and there's so many like points I want to make, sort of that I thought of as you were saying that. Like, I don't want to necessarily keep comparing the movies, but it's interesting that in a lot of ways, Muppets Take Manhattan just sort of retells the story of the Muppet movie, except instead of let's go to Hollywood and make a movie, it's let's go to New York and put on a Broadway show. And for me, one kind of works and the other one doesn't, even though they're very much still about show business. To me, and maybe it's because the second one is just repeating what the first one said, I don't know, but to me, the Muppet movie, you know, is such an interesting sort of statement on the creative process, and about, you know, forming this group of people that all have this similar goal and trying to make a dream come true as a unit, not just what can you do for me, but let's all do this together and make something happen, which is, of course, what, you know, it so much of it is almost like, not a metaphor, but is telling the story of sort of the Jim Henson, you know, workshop. And for a guy who was pretty, I think, distrustful of the studio system and big corporations and Hollywood in general, he was very protective of his properties. But the movie does have sort of a lack of cynicism about Hollywood in general. You know, again, the joke is that it's Orson Welles and he's sort of this fat cat behind a desk, and, you know, he's the standard sort of movie mogul that you see in movies. But Jim Henson is way more interested in sort of this magical idea of Hollywood, not the reality of what Hollywood is,
right,
but it's just sort of this fantasy version of what Hollywood is that maybe he grew up with, or maybe that he knows, you know, the kids that see the movie imagine Hollywood to be. Unfortunately, I don't think you can get away with that anymore. I mean, in 1979, I think as a society, we were so much less cynical about Hollywood because we had way less access to it.
Mm-hmm.
The internet and tabloids and all that have definitely tarnished the mystique of Hollywood. But in 79, it was still just this magical place. And the Muppet movie totally buys into that and sort of sells that idea. I love the whole movie within a movie idea. And maybe it just speaks to the fact that I have always loved movies, even as a kid, and could always sort of care less about Broadway shows, that I prefer one to the other, you know? I don't know.
I think there's probably something to that.
Probably, right?
As someone who shares that sentiment,
right.
It's great if you're making on Broadway, but...
Right, it's not the same as going to Hollywood and making
It's also cool different movie. Because in Muppets Take Manhattan, the Muppets already all know each other. They're all, you know, you don't have that kind of sense of discovery in the way you do the Muppet movie. Even The Great Muppet Caper, where... you know, you've got Kermit, Fozzie, and Gonzo as this main trio, and then they encounter everyone else. Granted, 95% of the rest of the Muppets are all living in the Happiness Hotel, so you kind of get them all in one go.
Right.
But you know, but by the third movie, you know, it's there's a little bit of a sense of familiarity, and like you said, then they basically split the Muppets up for the entire movie.
Right.
And Kermit's in New York interacting with humans, which is never all that interesting, and another reason why I'm a little worried about the new Muppet movie. You know, I think the things that work in Muppets Take Manhattan, I think some of my favorite parts, and the parts I remember, you know, when I saw it in the theater as a kid, are, you know, all of the postcards that Kermit gets, you know, letting him know what everyone else is doing. There's some funny stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, when the Scooter's working in the movie theater with New Zealand throwing the fish during the killer fish movie, and you know, and Gonzo doing the water skiing. So there are definitely funny moments in Muppets Take Manhattan, and I think that if we can agree, the first three Muppet movies are special in their own way, and that there's just kind of a diminishing returns after the first one. It's not to say that they're not great movies or at least good movies, each in their own right. But the first movie just kind of it's just so great.
It really is so great. And I, you know, again, we try and sort of stay away from just turning podcasts into like, there's nothing wrong with this movie. It's so great. But I really have a hard time sort of picking apart the Muppet movie. I just think it's a movie that does so many things right. And could never be done again, you know? And it holds such a place in the minds and imaginations of kids who see it. We both have young kids who are, you know, probably pretty soon going to be, you know, they won't necessarily get it, but I definitely want to, I'm already trying to like introduce my son to the Muppets, cause they're just so great. And he's definitely from before he was born, I hung up posters for the original three Muppet movies in his bedroom. Like that was his room decor. Was like, yeah, I'm going to get this kid into the Muppets. Cause I just love it. And this was before they were making this new movie. So now it's like, oh boy, they're everywhere. This is great. But I can't even tell you how obsessed I was with the original Muppet movie as a kid. And it wasn't, you know, I didn't have it on VHS or whatever. It was like, maybe they would show it on TV, or maybe they would have a screening of it at the public library. I know I used to regularly check out the soundtrack, the album from the library, and play it over and over again, and had it memorized to the point where my grandpa used to make these recordings of us just talking and stuff. And many of the recordings of me are me singing songs from the Muppet movie, including the one at the end. And I even do that whole like orchestral part when the balloons fly off and the studio starts crashing around. I sing that whole thing. It goes on forever. It's just gibberish, but like I had it, every beat of it memorized. And when I got married several years ago, the bride dances with her father and the groom dances with his mom, you know, not at all weddings, but at our wedding, that's what we did. And the song that I danced to with my mom was The Rainbow Connection.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm with you. Like I say, I definitely watched Great Muppet Caper more. Although I'm pretty sure that I had some sort of like picture book of the first one, because I remember like still shots of like everyone on top of the roof of the El Slizo, because Father said the drinks were on the house. Like I remember seeing that in a book, and I know at one point I had like the sheet music for the original Muppet movie. I had that book from somewhere, and yeah, like I mean, I was way obsessed with the Muppets. I mean, I think we all have our short lists of media that, you know, really influenced us, you know, as kids throughout our lives, and the Muppets are absolutely on that list for me. I mean, a lot of my most vivid memories from when I was a kid involved the Muppets in some way. I remember we didn't go to see a ton of movies when I was a kid, but I remember going to see Muppets Take Manhattan when it came out.
Yeah, me too.
I remember some, I guess maybe, I think it was a Saturday night. I was bad in some way, and my punishment was that I had to go to bed and not watch the Muppet Show. Like I remember that. And then when Jim Henson died, I was 12, 13, And that was the first time a celebrity death like affected me, and I remember that. I still somewhere in a box I have a newspaper clipping that I cut out from you know the day after he died, and wow. And you know and still I think that you know of all the famous people who have died since, he's probably still the one that you know I would miss the most.
Well, because there will never be another.
Right.
Jim Henson. I started a couple years ago, a book came out called Street Gang, which is about the mm-hmm. behind the scenes of Sesame right. Street.
Yep.
And I own the book and I still have not read the book because I read the first chapter and I had to stop because I got so upset because it's just talking about this like dinner conversation with Jim Henson
mm-hmm.
where he's talking about how he doesn't want to sell to Disney, that he's protective of his characters and he only wants them to be sort of educational for kids and he wants them to send the right messages to kids. He doesn't want them just plastered everywhere the way Disney would do. And it bummed me out so much because I just know there's never going to be another guy mm-hmm. like that. And there are so few, you know, kind of figures like that, especially in entertainment, but even in just the world. It made me really sad. And I have yet to read the book because yeah. I just got so sad thinking about he's gone and we will never have another Jim Henson.
Yeah, I got that book out of the library and I read at least that much too. I think I read a little bit more, but yeah, I should have left that part of the book with the sense that had he survived, maybe the Muppets wouldn't be owned by Disney now.
I don't think they would be.
I don't. I mean, I sort of see, you know, the way the Muppets are, you know, both shown and you know portrayed and kind of held behind this sort of gate. As being the kind of thing that Doc Hopper would do, maybe more so right. than Jim Henson, and right. and so I mean the fact that you know that we don't have, I don't know, it's a silly thing, but like you know the what we have the movies on DVD, they're not terribly great transfers, and that's right. all we have. We don't have Blu-rays. The Muppets Take Manhattan is out on Blu-ray. That's because Disney doesn't own that movie. It's I think Sony has it. So. You know, I sort of thought, well, maybe they'll put them out with the movie, you know, coming right. out. But all they've done is basically put, you know, coupons in the existing DVDs to mm-hmm. get some money to see the new movie. And maybe they'll do it when the new one comes out on, you know, on Blu-ray too. But it's just this kind of sense of overexposure and milking that I, you know, it seems out of the spirit of the Muppets as they originally were. And watching the first three movies, you just kind of get a sense of what that spirit was.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously you have more kind of tangible differences, like the fact that a lot of the voices are kind of different now. I mean, Kermit, well, the first time I heard Kermit's new voice, which I think was, they had some special, may have been part of the Jim Henson Hour. I think it was just its own special after Jim Henson died and Kermit came on at the end and said goodbye, Jim. And, you know, that's obviously now I'm, you know, crying, but, you know, it was like, okay, this is, you know, things are never going to be the same from mm-hmm. here on out. You know, we talked very briefly about the movies that have come out since, and, you know, like you watched two of them. I think I watched, you know, 2 minutes of one of them, and it's just, you know, it's like, this is not what I want to watch. This is not the Muppets to me. And, you know, it is the Muppets to a lot of kids, I'm sure. And I guess is what it is. If they are introduced to the Muppets and maybe want to go back and watch right. the old movies, watch the old TV shows. And I mean, there were a lot of other great Muppet things too. I mean, I loved Muppet Babies when I was a kid, like the Saturday cartoon, the Jim Henson Hour, which was a really, really great show. And he did more adult stuff, the Storyteller, you know, sequences, even like Dark Crystal. I loved. I mean, there's so many Fraggle Rock. I mean, there's so many great things. Obviously Sesame Street, you know, that you want to talk about, you know, influential. I mean, I watched the heck out of that when I was a kid. And all these kind of just sort of pure expressions of what Jim Henson was interested in as a person, not just as a creative force. And it's sad not to have that anymore.
It absolutely is. I was so obsessed as a kid with just all things puppets. And obviously Jim Henson sort of had his hand in all of those things. So I loved Fraggle Rock. I just loved everything. Honestly, the only thing that kind of left me Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas I loved. I've never been the world's biggest Labyrinth fan.
Sure. And I guess I don't really think of that as being a I know it is a Jim Henson,
right?
But I don't think of it in the same way as the other ones. I think
well, because it's always kind of brought up in the same breath as The Dark Crystal, which to me, I'm a big fan of The Dark Crystal, and yeah, not so much of Labyrinth. And again, The Dark Crystal is sort of a showcase for, like, you know, Jim Henson wanted to do more than just kid stuff. I mean, you know, Dark Crystal is still theoretically for kids, but it was this idea that, you know, we don't just have to use puppets to educate kids, or it could be used, they could be used in a number of ways. And here's this incredibly ambitious, elaborate fantasy film done 100% with puppets. Mm-hmm. And it's like nothing that's been made before or since. Do you remember even like when Muppet Babies first came on the air, it was part of a block. There was a show that ran with it called Little Muppet Monsters.
Oh, sounds vaguely familiar, but
I mean, it maybe ran for a month. It was so short-lived, and I don't know what happened. It got canceled, or it was too expensive. I don't know. And then they just went back to just Muppet Babies. But I mean, the block used to be like 90 minutes long. But yeah, I loved Muppet Babies as a kid, and I got to tell you, the first time, you know, predating Muppet Babies, that sequence in Muppets Take Manhattan where it shows them as kids. Again, just like you, we did not go see very many movies as kids, maybe one a year, maybe. And we went to see Muppets Take Manhattan, and I had like an issue of Muppet Magazine that had pictures.
I love Muppet Magazine.
Yes. And the issue I had, I remember being on vacation in Missouri, and all I had to read was this Muppet Magazine. I just read it over and over again because it had pictures of the Muppet Babies sequence from Muppets Take Manhattan. I mean, that made my head explode. Like, yeah. I was so excited about this idea of, like, oh my gosh, we're going to see them as babies. I have no idea why. And I still think it's my favorite, you know, 2.5 minutes in all of Muppets Take Manhattan.
It's a great sequence. It's a great song.
Yeah.
I think the music is obviously so important in all these movies. I would definitely say that, you know, the first movie has the best songs, best song collection by far. If only just because they're all, you know, for the most part, they kind of stand on their own in some way as songs. I mean, you know, Moving Right Along obviously describes what's going on, but even then, like, I could listen to that on its own out of the context of the movie and enjoy it. Mm-hmm. Whereas maybe in Great Muppet Caper, you know, the Happiness Hotel song, funny, but, you know, completely about what's happening in it's more like a musical. It's less
right.
like just the song in a movie. I think the Great Muppets Take Manhattan has kind of returns a little bit there. I mean, there's some very good songs in that one too. The one for the Muppet Babies sequence, the sort of the overall theme together again, and then the, you know, the actual musical sequence at the end that culminates with Miss Piggy and Kermit getting married. I still remember seeing that in the theater. I still like it when I watch it. It's a nice kind of homage to like a Singing in the Rain type of type of thing.
Right.
So. Yeah, so the music is great in all these.
Yeah, the first movie has songs by Paul Williams, who as a kid I mostly knew from like his one guest spot on Gimme a Break, where he was like this dying singer who was mad that he got a blood transfusion with Nell Carter because he was horribly racist, and that's how I knew Paul Williams. He was that short little weird guy who was racist against Nell. And then I grew up, obviously, and realized he wrote the songs for the Muppet movie and wrote all the songs and starred in Phantom of the Paradise, which, again, if you listen to the show, you know, is one of my favorite movies of all time and has incredible songs. And so it gives me great joy to know that he made this crazy sort of horror rock fantasy, did all the songs, but he also wrote these great songs for this sort of gentle, sweet kids movie. The songs in the first one are great, and I was reminded, again, going through the three movies this time, how sort of spotty the songs in the second two movies are. That there's a few that are great and really stand out, and then there's some that are just really disposable, kind of, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly watching the second movie, I remembered songs in that I recognized them.
Right.
But if, you know, before watching, if you'd said, you know, name me, you know, three songs from The Great Muppet Caper, I don't know that I could have done that.
Yeah, I definitely could not have, I don't think. But this reminds me, because there's one character who has a song, at least one song in pretty much every movie. who I have never been a fan of. And I have to ask you, do you have a favorite and a least favorite Muppet?
Okay, favorite, least favorite Muppet. Are you talking about Ralph?
No, I'm not. I'm actually talking about Miss Piggy. Yes. Since I was a small child, yeah. I have never been a Miss Piggy fan.
That's very fair. I think that she is probably the weakest thing in all three movies. And
she's so prominent. She's like one of the big two, you know?
You could make the argument that all three movies are about Miss Kermit and Miss Piggy's relationship. And so, I mean, that...
Right.
Like, those are basically the big, you know, kind of emotional climaxes of the movie. In fact, right. The whole trilogy ends with them getting married. So it's, you know, it's about their on again, off again relationship. There are no Miss Piggy songs that I would consider to be my favorite at all. And she definitely tends to slow things down a bit. At least favorite Muppets. I mean, you picked a pretty good one. I've always loved Gonzo. I've always I like the weird, you know, the weird guys. I think as much as I like Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem, their songs are good but not great. I mean, for me, like, I like those parts of the movies, but I don't love them. Like, whenever they have a great kind of psychedelic, you know, song going on, like, Can You Picture That is perfectly fine, but I would listen to, you know, I'm going to Go Back There Someday a million times, you know, before I go back to... But I, you know, I guess I have a tough time, you know, saying I dislike any particular Muppet. I don't know if anyone... I mean, I think so. Some of the Rolf songs I do like. I forget the name of the song.
In the original, I hope something better comes along.
Yes. Which is a great song, but it's, you know, I think part of it might just be the musical style.
Right. Well, it's got that whole late night sort of lounge vibe, you know. And again, as a kid, I couldn't even necessarily – I didn't understand sort of the trope that was playing into.
Sure. Right.
I was just like, all right, he's going to sing a song at the piano. And he makes reference to drinking a beer and taking himself for a walk. And it's just like, okay, whatever.
Right.
Yeah, as a kid, I really loved Rolf. I don't know why he spoke to me so much. But yeah, there's no Muppet I really dislike – with the exception of...
And I feel bad about that, because I feel like I don't know, it makes me feel like a sexist pig.
Oh, hey now.
Ironically.
I will say, I do love Can You Picture That in the first movie, but their song, and I just had to look it up on Wikipedia, because I could not for the life of me remember their song from Great Muppet Caper, the Dr. Teeth song, Nightlife.
Yeah, earlier this year the Muppet tribute album came out. I forget what it's called, but it's like,
oh, okay, yeah.
Ian Green, or I don't know what it was, but there are a lot of you know, like Weezer covers, Rainbow Connection, and and that I saw that was on there, and I saw that it was from the Great Muppet Caper, so I listened to, you know, a clip of that song, and it sounded completely unfamiliar to me.
Yeah.
Watching in the movie, you know, I was like, okay, that was that song, but yeah, I couldn't sing it for you. It's pretty, you know, unremarkable in that way.
I feel like my favorite Muppet, I feel like, changes all the time, you know, which again is sort of a testament, I think, to how sort of great those characters are. Not that they're necessarily particularly like dimensional or whatever, you know, they're all sort of like, this guy's like this and this guy's like this. But on a given day, I would say Kermit the Frog is my favorite Muppet, because I still love his earnestness. I love, you know, Fozzie Bear's just silliness. I love Gonzo because he's an outsider. I loved Animal as a kid so much, and I forgot that he's, you know, sort of a rapist in the original three movies. He's not really. He's constantly chasing down women and terrifying them. But again, to talk about sort of an iconic moment from the first movie, I swear I used to watch the entire first Muppet movie just to get to the scene where his head pops out of the building at the end, because I loved it so much. And I used to, as a kid, recreate. I had these little Muppet figurines. They didn't have any like points of articulation or whatever. Like, maybe their legs went up and down, but that was it. But then I had this big like animal puppet. Just the head sort of moved, and the rest of his body was just sort of this thin thing of like floppy felt.
Mm-hmm.
But so that I was able to recreate the end. I would put the song, the score on the album, and I would have the little guys, and I would take one of my sister's dollhouses, and at the appropriate moment, I would have the giant animal puppet bust through the roof of the dollhouse just to continually recreate what was my favorite moment from the original.
That's great. I mean, who as a kid doesn't want a giant animal head to go scare away the bully? I mean,
right? It's so great.
It's really great. Oh, yeah. And he doesn't get a lot of play, but I've always been a big fan of Sweetums.
Yeah, too. Yeah.
I always liked the big full body monster Muppets.
As did I, yeah. And Sweetums was always kind of in a weird place for me, because in the original Muppet movie, again, he's sort of very nice and he wants to belong and he's constantly chasing them down because he wants to be part of the group and he wants to be in the movie. But I grew up listening to – it was a special that aired on TV that I never really saw. It was just that I had an album of Jim Henson's Frog Prince.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think
it came out on VHS eventually, but it's got like the princess who talks backwards, and there's some like genuinely scary moments, especially when you're just listening to the album. And Sweetums is sort of a villain in that.
Okay.
And so it was always hard to sort of disassociate. In the Muppet movie, he's their friend and he wants to be part of the group, but in this other thing, he's the villain, and so I always held him at arm's length.
That's fair. I think that maybe in the same way that Miss Piggy drags things down, I'm not always the biggest fan of Robin. He's okay. I think he certainly has his moments, and I think that he can add a sweetness to things that works well. But I don't know. He can also drag things down.
Yeah,
just a little bit,
right? And he's almost the whole show in the Frog Prince.
Right.
And it's interesting because I feel like if the Muppets were new now and they came out with a Robin character, I would accuse them of just trying to sell a new toy to younger kids. Right. You know what I mean? Like, oh, well, young kids need their Muppet too, so here's Robin.
He'd be like the Scrappy-Doo of the Muppet
world. Exactly. And to some extent, I think, you know, that's a little bit of what the Muppet Babies were, you know, I think they were sort of more marketing driven than creatively driven, if that makes it. You know, I don't think Jim Henson felt the need to tell the story of the Muppets when they were kids, but it was like, but here's a whole new line of stuff we can make. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong.
I don't know. I just remember they had a lot of like, you know, scenes ripped out of Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark, and
which
stuff.
Is why it will never come out on DVD, and it's so upsetting. When I go to comic conventions, sometimes there's people with bootlegs of like the entire series, and they're always asking way too much money. But I'm always kind of tempted because it would be great to go back, especially with my son, and revisit so many of those shows, which again had a great message about the importance of imagination and make believe, and you know, making your own fun, which doesn't really happen anymore, sort of in the age of video games, you know. But nothing against video games.
I don't know. Plus, it had a great theme song. So
it absolutely did. Yeah.
I mean, it sort of seems like pretty much everything Jim Henson had a hand in was good, if not great.
Yeah. With the exception of the original Muppets on Saturday Night Live, which
yes, and that feels. I mean, that the you get the feeling that that was just an unhappy relationship from the beginning.
Yeah.
And I don't even know how much he wanted to do that. I've only seen one or two of those sketches. I think I only saw it because I reviewed several seasons of the original, you know, series, and they were on, I think their last episode was the first episode of the second season. And I reviewed this. So that's really all I saw of them. And it just seemed weird. I mean, it's just the wrong venue for the Muppets, and I think the characters were not, you know, not appropriate for that.
Right.
Whereas, you know, I did watch the Muppets appearance on Saturday Night Live this past week.
Yeah.
In the opening, you know, monologue segment, that was, you know, that they fit better in that way. You know, at the same time, it's nothing to compare the way the Muppets are in the Muppet movie, but at least, you know, it shows that they can be funny, they can be a little irreverent, they can, you know, they can fit some of the vibe of a variety show, which makes sense because that's what the Muppet Show was.
But yeah, and seeing them come on Saturday Night Live didn't bother me again. It was like, oh, yay, the Muppets are on. But like and I didn't see this, but I know that they showed up like maybe on professional wrestling, and oh, I've seen them like on like cell phone commercials. I don't know. There's just things that make me sad a little bit because, again, like you said, I don't think these things would be happening quite so much if Jim Henson were still around.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's kind of like what would happen if Bill Watterson suddenly died and someone sold Calvin and Hobbes to Disney, and then all of a sudden it wouldn't be the same.
No, because then he would just pee on everything. Right now, I think he only pees on Fords right now. But
it depends. Chevy's too, I think. Honestly, I think he'll pee on anything. I've heard that about Calvin. I don't want to talk out of school.
That guy will pee on anything.
Oh, boy. This was a nice family podcast a minute ago.
All right, well, I guess that's pretty much all we have to say about the Muppets. I'm really curious about the new one. I hope that it is more in keeping with the original three than with sort of the later movies. And everything I've read, you know, definitely suggests that Jason Segel and Nick Stoller are coming from very much a place of sort of reverence, especially for the original Muppet movie, if not that original trilogy. And that's sort of what they're trying to recreate. So we'll see. I don't know.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, I think I imagine it's not going to be the same.
Right.
The Muppets themselves are different enough now, and you know, the people who kind of own them are different enough now that it's probably, hopefully, if you can just capture just a percentage of that spirit,
right,
and that playfulness, and get to that just sense of just whimsy and kind of old style vaudevillian comedy that it just kind of just throughout the first movie and the first two movies, it's just so great. So I will keep an open mind and and an open something Muppet related. I got nothing. I don't know.
Eric Gasperschlager, you are no one's puppet.
Although I'm willing to be for the right price. Please send your offers to.
Thank you everybody for listening. Happy Thanksgiving to everyone. And we will see you next week in the post-Muppet world. Bye.